I'm Graham Bradley. I'm the chairman of United Malt, and I've met several of you before, but I would like to thank all of you for attending our session today, in particular those of you who've travelled interstate to be with us this morning. This is a day when you will meet and hear from a number of the leaders amongst our senior management group and to hear their presentations, but I would like to make a few introductory comments on behalf of the board, particularly given the disappointing market announcement that we put out last Monday. I'm also here to listen to your comments and concerns so that we can ensure that to the extent we can, and consistent with our disclosure obligations, provide you with the information that you need to fully understand the company's performance, its situation and its future prospects. Now, before going on, I would like to take this opportunity to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet here today, and pay respects to elders past and present. Today, management will help you better understand the very real strengths of United Malt's business and the reasons why both the board and our management team believe there are grounds for confidence that the company can achieve material improvements in financial outcomes in FY23 and beyond, once the storms that have impacted us over the past 6 months are abated. But at the outset, I want to say that we fully acknowledge your disappointment and our disappointment also at the revised outlook that we advised the market of on Monday. While there have been a number of extraordinary factors that have impacted the business over the past 6 months, the Canadian drought, the need to import grain in a tight shipping environment, the poor quality of the barley that we received in North America, resulting in poor malt conversion and associated increased costs, container and rail freight disruptions, particularly in North America, which have continued, and also the energy price hikes that have resulted from the conflict in Ukraine, we also acknowledge that our organisation and our commercial arrangements were, put simply, not well adapted to protect our margins from these previously unseen circumstances. With hindsight, our organisation did not react quickly enough or foresee or respond to the full consequences of the situation that we faced. Now, I'm here to say also that the board acknowledges the need for the organisation to do much better, to execute the actions that we need, many of which I'm pleased to say are already underway, and you'll hear more about them in the presentations, to make our business more resilient from such shocks in the future, and we need to do so effectively and quickly. We recognise that our tasks are the following, and I'll cite five key priorities for the board and management. Firstly, we need to strengthen the skills and capability of our management bench, including filling several currently vacant key executive roles with quality candidates. Second, we need to reduce the risks inherent in our current commercial arrangements to shield our returns from future volatility in barley prices and cost input inflation. You'll hear more about that in the presentation today. Three, we need to ensure cost efficiency right across our global organisation by further streamlining our processes and reducing duplication. And fourth, we need to generate better returns on our past and also our current capital expenditure, and we must also maintain a rigorous approach to all new CapEx moving forward. And lastly, we need to add some deeper industry experience to our board, particularly in North America. And in that regard, we will be shortly announcing a new highly experienced US-based non-executive director who will join the board in the next few weeks. The board is committed to delivering these improvements at pace. Over the next 6 months, I have agreed with my board colleagues that I will visit the United States frequently and be deeply engaged in helping the management team maintain the momentum for the changes that we need to put in place. So in summary, the board is fully supportive and believes that there is a very material uplift in our performance that is there to be realized in FY23 and in FY24 and beyond, and we do intend to deliver that uplift. So today you'll hear from management as to how they plan to go about those improvements. So those are my opening comments, so I want to thank you again for attending, and I'll hand over to our Chief Executive, Mark Palmquist, to begin the presentation. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Graham. Good morning, everyone. I want to start off and just echo the commitment that Graham has laid out and with the board. We certainly had an extraordinary year that we went through and a lot of external events. We've learned a lot of the process, absolutely developed some new capabilities, very proud of how a lot of our employees responded to it. But we also exposed some inadequacies that we have inside the organization. And part of it is missing some people capabilities or skills. More importantly, we noticed some of our processes were not up to snuff to provide us with appropriate information and decision-making that went on, and so we are definitely working on those components right now. And I also would just comment on that I think our level of responsiveness in certain conditions were probably slower than what they should be. And that, to me, speaks a lot to leadership. There's a lot in that that I hold myself accountable for in being able to now institute those changes and make sure that we are absolutely improving not just our decision-making but improving our execution on the issues at hand and just being more responsive. So we've got some work to do on a go-forward basis as we make these improvements. But we feel clearly that we can see what it is we do need to do, and we are executing a lot of those changes now, and they're on foot. But we definitely have the challenges in front of it, and we understand that, and we hold ourselves accountable for making those improvements because I would agree with Graham. I think United Malt has some really nice opportunities and actually should hold itself accountable for actually improving the returns because we have strength in the organization, we're operating in a good industry, and as we make these improvements, we'll just get better at what we do. So I embrace and look forward to the challenge that we have in front of us. So I want to start off with, before we get into the Investor Day, because I'm really looking forward to it, one is I think you'll understand why I have great confidence in a lot of the new leadership that we brought in and what the opportunities we have on a go-forward basis. But we put out the release on guidance just a couple days ago, and I think I've been remiss in not talking about the balance sheet issue and why we're sitting here with confidence that we can work our way through the increased debt levels versus EBITDA levels and the process that we're going through. So let me just spend just a little bit of time on that. And as you know, the announcements that we had for FY22 and FY23, certainly it was very disappointing that we're having to track lower on a guidance just 2 months after we had put guidance out. And so that's one of the issues that we have. But most importantly, as we go forward and look at this, is now that we're in this type of earnings level, it certainly is increasing our net debt to EBITDA. And why we have confidence that we can handle this from a debt circumstance and not requiring an equity raise for us to be able to work through this. And I just want to talk a little bit more about that. And the big issue is, so what's the confidence we have that we're going to see this material change in profitability? And there's a number of factors behind it. The obvious one is that we clearly have a different issue going on in terms of the North American crop versus where it was in 22. So we have a crop that is just starting to get harvested in the U.S. We'll be 2 to 3 weeks away from getting into harvest in a big way in Canada. But we're really reaching that point of having much better certainty on the availability of supply and quality. And that in itself is a huge positive impact for us going into FY23. It's not just about price, but it's that complexity. It's a supply chain that's not running thousands and thousands of kilometers. We have it in our backyard. That does a number of things. It gives us certainty in terms of when the supply is in. We have a better quality selection rate, which really helps a lot in the productivity inside of the plants. And we're less exposed to the transportation costs just because the supply chain is just so dramatically shorter than what we're having in FY22. One of the inadequacies that was exposed in FY22, and Graham mentioned this, is the pricing and commercial terms. What we had in place in a lot of the contracts in 22 didn't give us the flexibility that we really should have had. And part of it is that we should have been executing, and I'll go back to this slow on responsiveness aspect of it, where that is corrected in place, and I'm going to go through that with you on a later slide just to show you the fundamental changes that goes into that. But that gives us great comfort when we look at it and saying that we see the improvement in our margins, which translates into profitability in FY23. And I'll just tell you is that we're now in excess of 70% of our business is already locked from an aspect of barley price and malt price. So we can see with much greater clarity this year in terms of where we actually are, will be driving the profitability on that side. We have the completion of the Scottish expansion project coming in place. We'll have commercial production by the end of this calendar year. We have 80% of that capacity sold out at this point in time on Inverness, and the 80% is intentional. We want to make sure that we've got a little wiggle room in there that we're satisfying our customers. If we've got some, I would just say, more kind of efficiency improvement on the commissioning of the plant. And the other reason very intentionally that we've done that is because we really want to go after a market there that we haven't had the capacity to do, and that's going after the kind of the boutique, small independent distillers, which brings in a whole other set of customers for us and typically a better margin on that side of the business. So in saying that, we will be operating at a net debt to EBITDA that exceeds the range that we feel is the long-term range we should live inside of, and that's 2 to 2.5 times. But we see a clear pathway where we can get to that by the 30th of September. And so we are comfortable that we can operate that higher level, and I'd say that for a number of reasons. One is that we don't have any major capital commitment to come forward in FY23. We're saying we're going to be in $55, $60 million for spend on CapEx, considerably lower than what we are finishing up in 2022. And we think that we have a number of options that are viable for us to take a look at, options such as looking at accounts receivable and inventory financing. And the other component I would say is that we have been and will continue to be in active and positive discussions with our banks. We are fortunate that the banks that provide us access to debt are very knowledgeable in commodity markets. They're very knowledgeable in United Malt business, and we have been keeping our banks informed for quite some time in terms of where this all looked like it was going to head to. So We will work through that, and we'll explore the options, and certainly we'll have those in place before we get to the end of our fiscal year 22-30 September. So again, we feel confident that this is the right thing to do. We don't have any, what I would say, long-term increased needs for capital. And so this can be well managed on the debt side. And at this stage, we don't see any reason that we would be putting forward an equity raise. Finally, we will certainly keep you informed on the progress and where we're at, and we'll once we work through the options and in conjunction with our banks, we'll set a plan for go forward, and we will certainly tell you what that is. So I can't tell you how happy I am, by the way, that we finally get a chance to have an investor meeting physically. Operating on a very virtual base from the day we started the organization. This is just really great to do. But most importantly is try to give you some confidence to why we're so excited about the future and where we see the opportunities and how we're going to drive that. So I'm going to go through a process here that I want to be able to really showcase the new talent that we have brought in the team. They'll show you where their accountabilities lie for driving the improvements that we need to do inside of the organization. And then I'm just going to run through the agenda that we've actually got stacked in two different sessions. So we'll certainly give you a break and have an opportunity to grab a cup of coffee or a tea, and then we can work our way through the agenda. So first thing I want to do is tell you who's going to be presenting and who's with us today. Most of them physically, one virtually, having a little back problem issue, so was advised not to get on a plane. Otherwise, he would have loved to have been here. But we'll capture him on a virtual basis here. So I'm going to just start to the right of me as you see it on the pictures. And the first one, and we made announcements, and that's Ryan Dutcher, who's stepping in as our interim CFO. I just highlight the fact that actually Ryan has been working inside our organization with the leadership team since February, coming in and really looking at our finance function and how we need to evolve that to better fit what we need inside of United Malt, and at the same time with the ERP system coming in. In the last 45 days, we've had him concentrated on our processing, our forecasting processes to better understand some of the inadequacies that we've had in our forecasting in FY22 and make the changes necessary for us, again, to build confidence on how we look at FY23. He has 25 years of experience in both public and private companies, multiple interim CFO roles, and has really provided really a lot of improvements that we're executing already in evolving our finance function inside the organization. Next to him is Tiago De Rocha. Tiago came in just over a year ago as our chief operating officer, invaluable for us as we had to reverse our supply chain and get processes in place for that. As importantly, already driving some process developments, most notably sales and operation process inside the organization. We're happy to have him because he's our absolute in-house expert in terms of what a brewer is looking for and how that translates into quality considerations, what we can do to help our customers out and do it in a manner that we also mutually benefit from. And he will take you through that, and I'm sure Tiago will probably talk about your background a little bit more as we go through that. Next to Tiago is Brian Bichard. Brian has been with us since 2007. Brian is came along with when we actually purchased Country Malt to get into the craft business. And Brian's been I'll just call it industry leader in this area, and we're very fortunate to have had his tenure. And he continues to develop and innovate that business, and he will take you through that as well. But I, the one thing I'd want to call out is it's easy to talk about the craft business, how important it is to us. I would be remiss to not mention that we've become really good at warehouse and distribution. And that's a capability that allows us for looking at adjacent expansions and other products that we can utilize full capacity of what we have built and utilize the capabilities that we have driven. And then finally, Erica Morgan, Chief People Officer. And one of the journeys that we've been taking on this is realizing that as we're making changes organizationally and trying to streamline and integrate components, that this is as much a change management and a cultural change inside the organization. Erica has years of experience in executing those type of areas, a decade with Nike, time with Mars, so well-suited to bring in the appropriate professionalism and capabilities that we need to move ourselves forward. So as I mentioned for today, we're going to have two sessions. First session, you know, business overview of some operating and marketing trading conditions, and then I'm going to go through that. I'm going to have Ryan come up and just talk about the delivery on medium-term financial objectives and a little bit of what you're working on, Ryan, as well. And then we'll take you know, 5-10 minutes for Q&A, do a break for 10 minutes, and then come back in again. And then the second session gets into a little bit more of what you would probably expect in an investor day, that we'll talk through strategy a little bit, but see how it's embedding into our processing area, in our warehouse and distribution area, and overall how we're integrating and executing that and getting support out of HR. And then we'll have QA at that point, and then we'll just wrap it up. So, again, appreciate having you here with us today, and our goal is to try to give you a good sense of where we think we're going and our commitment that we have behind that. So I'm going to start first with safety, which is a really core value that we have inside of United Malt. And this is something that we look at safety as a reflection in terms of how the organization is operating. Typically, companies that have good safety records, you'll find that they're very successful companies because they've got good processes in place and good strategies in place. And so we're certainly continually improving on this. Feel satisfied by the lost time injury frequency rate not increasing, but we are definitely dedicated to keep improving that. And I know that's a very strong spot for Tiago as well. So just responding to challenging conditions, I think Graham brought a little bit of this up. What we're seeing is that, you know, for on a go-forward basis, we're having an improved crop, but we've got some risk management and commercial issues, disciplines that we definitely need to improve, and we're definitely doing that right now and working forward on that. Again, if I go back to 22, we certainly had a lot of challenges, and we were going to have I would say continuation of some of those challenges, but at a substantially lower level than what we experienced in FY22. But it still means that we have to be adjusting our organization and learning how to deal with volatility, and I would call external events that you may not be able to predict or control, but we should be able to manage and mitigate the risk that comes along with that. So the big area that we have instituted and are working on right now is getting better at how we handle the risk on a barley pricing and the quality issue. And I'm going to take you to a chart and show you the changes that we have made. But also, there has been a fundamental shift that has gone on over the past 10 years or so, where the risk has been working its way over onto the maltster, to the malt company, and moving further away from the customer. And one is that imbalance that's going on means we're absorbing more risk for the reward that we get for participating in the business. But also it means that some of that risk can best be mitigated by our customer, and so that risk should lie with them. And a lot of it comes into the performance issues. So it gets into how we do the barley pricing, and we have fundamentally changed how we do that. I'll go through that. One is a more disciplined approach to our customers living to their volume commitments, both in time as well as the tonnage. Getting freight priced and reset more multiple times so that we can deal with disruptions in supply chains, but also the cost and inflation that we're experiencing. And having our processing fees have adjustability to it in order so that it truly is covering what we're seeing in inflation costs. Just throw this up here quickly, just to lay out the kind of the groundwork that just because we're getting a good crop in Canada doesn't mean that prices are going to be dropping dramatically, and the volatility and the risk of that has gone by because we're seeing it in other areas. So thank goodness we are seeing North America have a much improved crop situation, but the EU is has dropped some production. And as importantly, we still have the Black Sea issue about getting exports coming out of that area that's going to keep that volatility in place. For us on a crop update, we've talked about Canada. The fundamental difference is a 10.2 million ton crop versus 6.9. That makes it very clear to us we won't be importing this year in order to deal with any supply shortage. As importantly, having quality in our backyard, we'll have a higher selection rate of quality that absolutely adds productivity into our facilities and really removes a lot of the risk that we've had in the past. I'll just mention us, U.S. very, very quickly. We're getting a crop that's almost 50% bigger. So, again, we'll have similar conditions for selection and supply there. And for Scotland, they're going to be harvesting and starting in the next 2-3 weeks. That's early. Normally, it's not until we get to September, middle of September, and we're getting ourselves prepared for Inverness coming up on stream. So we're in process of procuring an additional 42,000 tons to take care of that. I'm going to just a final slide. I wanted to go into this on the pricing commercial discipline. Kind of the before and what we're what we've implemented, and it's these are the three major categories. So it's around barley, and that's a quality and a price issue, around a processing fee and transportation. And I've made mention to them just a couple minutes ago, but wanted to show it in terms of area and kind of customer. So warehouse and distribution, excuse me, that's primarily that's our craft business, right? And Brian and his team have had the opportunity to make adjustments as they go along. But just because they've had that opportunity, they've actually accelerated that. And what we talk about is dynamic pricing. What we mean by that is that multiple opportunities to adjust price based upon availability, quality, and what the actual price is. And that is in the craft side. And you can see it in warehouse and distribution's results, that they're not impacted with the same risks and narrowing of margins that we're experiencing on the processing side. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that they're able to adjust their price, their fee that's embedded inside of the price of the malt, and transportation in real time adjusting the cost. So here's what we're affecting over on the processing side. Most of what we had in both our short-term contracts and our long-term contracts was basically an annual pricing mentality on all three categories. We now have changed on our contracts that are year or less where we are in a dynamic pricing model. So what does that mean inside of processing? That we are not taking on the risk of the price until we develop more certainty around availability, both in supply as well as quality, and then also what does that mean for a price relationship both locally as well as on a global base. And on the transportation side of it that we have gone to now, where the price of the transportation kind of get adjusted for what it actually costs us at the time that we do the shipment. On the long-term agreements, they typically are 3 years long. We have them staggered, so roughly a third of it rolls off each year. I would just tell you that on a volume base, depending upon the region, 60 to 70% of our business lies inside of long-term agreements. And so we, as we're making these changes, it will take us a couple years to roll it across 100% of our contracts in the long-term agreements, with the exception of barley. Barley is something that we have gone to dynamic pricing. We have the capabilities under our existing contracts. We were slow in really executing it in 2022. We haven't been slow at it for our business in 2023. We've got, again, as I mentioned, we've got over 70% of our volume business booked now for 2023, and that's all inside of the dynamic pricing for the barley side. Processing fees, as we're negotiating renewals, we're adding capabilities in that processing fee that typically was set for 3 years. Now it's an annual adjustment that can be done through a consumer price index adjustment. It can be done through escalation per year of negotiated processing fees, or that fee can be left open and negotiated as we come into each year. And then, of course, transportation, going back or changing it to pricing at time of shipment. So we're executed, it's in place, it will take down a lot of that risk that we have in bearing those costs, and certainly helps us maintain the margins going forward. So just another reason why we have more certainty around dramatic improvement on the earnings in FY23. So with that, Ryan, I'll ask you to come up here and go through financial objectives.
Thank you, Mark. As Mark mentioned, my name is Ryan Dutcher. I'm the interim CFO. I've been with the organization since February. I want to talk through a couple different pieces here. I want to, first of all, cover some of my observations stepping in as the CFO, so mainly talking about how the finance organization supports the business. I also want to walk you through, as I've gotten more deeply involved in the forecast, walk you through what I'm seeing in the forecast and what I believe are the business drivers. So I'm going to give you the next level of financial detail beneath what Mark just walked you through. So first of all, as I walk into the organization, I want to observe a couple different pieces. By and large, what I'm seeing across the finance organization is a highly skilled, dedicated team. I get great confidence in knowing that our core finance functions, so mainly our treasury function, our consolidation function that consolidates all of our results across all of our different business units and all of our different currencies, and our core finance leadership in our particular business units is strong. I'll give you an example. Our business leader, our finance leader in the United Kingdom, has been with the business for 25 years. Many of our other employees, our treasurer, for example, and other employees came from GrainCorp. They know the business well. They have good relationships across both within our company and with our external stakeholders as well. So that gives me great confidence. That said, we definitely have some improvements, and I've observed those improvements. I've gotten more deeply involved in those areas. The first piece, and I'll kind of walk you through where I'm spending my time specifically over the next few months, I really want to talk about our forecasting. We have some, I would call some financial process gaps in our forecasting. And to be one piece more specific, one level more specific, that's largely around how we consume the information that we know both within our four walls and that we know outside the marketplace. I think from a process point of view, we didn't fully understand the impact and how quickly some of this would hit us, and that led us to the result, the situation we're in, which I'm not happy with as well. The benefit of learning that as well is then it helps us be more active stewards of how the business performs. As a finance organization, we have a better grasp on what's really driving the business, and we can make sure we're applying our efforts and helping our executive partners apply their efforts on the pieces that we know are going to deliver the most value. And I think as I walk through my presentation here, you'll understand those themes that drive our business and where I'll talk about where I'm going to engage my team to make sure those pieces happen. I think one of the most important functions that finance and operations finance team performs is how we allocate our capital across the organization. And I mean CapEx, but I also mean our SG&A and our people's time and focus. So finance hasn't been deeply involved in that prioritization. I'm confident that the CEO, the COO, and other business unit leaders make that decision based on strategy and their knowledge of the market. I think there's a critical role that finance needs to play in making sure that our results are realistic, we can believe them. As the objective CFO, I'm comfortable enough to put them into the budget and our projections, and that we're getting a minimum IRR for any of our investments. So that's going to be a place where I'm going to spend a fair amount of effort, and that's going to start with our budget process that kicks off next month. We're going to put some serious dedicated effort behind that initiative. What that's going to give us is Mark, me, Tiago, making the best decisions we can around where to allocate our capital to where we're getting the best result. And you'll see our capital spend is going to be less than this next year, so that's going to be more critically important. The other piece is finance should be playing a very important role as I call it a scorekeeper within the organization. So giving us the confidence, we perform a little bit of an internal audit function, and we want to make sure we have the confidence that every dollar we're spending is going to give us that return. It's one thing to do it on the front end. It's another thing to make sure that we're collectively focusing on those key, on those most specific drivers to make sure we're either getting the return or we're taking corrective action to get those back on track. We also, one of the gaps, I mentioned the strengths in the finance organization. I believe the biggest gap we have right now is on the financial planning and analysis. And a good financial planning analysis function understands the business well. They are close partners with our COO and our sales teams to make sure that the decisions we're making on a day-to-day basis are going to give us the right financial result. They're not necessarily the operational experts, but they're the sounding board to make sure we're getting the right financial decisions. It's the analytical partnership that we provide. We have a legacy structure, not just in the organization, but also in the finance organization. We have, I'll call them finance silos within our business units. That doesn't necessarily give us the best results. A couple of things, we end up with some redundant functions and operations. We also end up with a suboptimal position where we have people that could contribute far more to the United Malt Group are focused on a much smaller part of the business. So there's a lot of information sharing that can be had across the organization and more with the United Malt focus versus a focus on a specific business unit so we get optimization across the entire company. The last piece, obviously our core finance responsibility involves AP, AR, our accounting functions. With a new ERP implementation, we'll be able to standardize those processes across all of our businesses. That gives us not only better access or better understanding of our controls, which are very important in terms of managing the risk the organization is taking on, but also gives us much more significant efficiencies as it relates to our team. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about what, when I was deeply involved in the forecast process, what I see as drivers of the medium term. A lot of these are going to mirror what Mark said. I want to apply a little more of a financial analytical lens to these because these are the key pieces that you'll see driving 23. The first piece is a more reliable, robust barley supply. Last year, we imported a fair amount of barley, drove our barley costs up in North America by almost twice. We don't believe that amount of volatility is going to happen in 2023. Mark mentioned the improved pricing and commercial disciplines. It's critically important to making sure we can maintain the margins going forward. I think this is important enough that I'm taking a senior director level person on my team. I'm going to dedicate 100% of their time to this process. And it's not only supporting this process because it involves by-contract analysis, not only is it supporting this process to make sure we're pricing with all of our, with all the correct costs, it's also making sure we have the discipline. So this is the person that makes sure that when we roll out and make a decision about pricing, gets implemented in the contract, and we as a company follow through and holding our customers to the agreement. From a supply chain point of view, I'm being a little bit cautious on the supply chain. We expect we're still going to have some disruptions and some challenges. Probably get a little bit of relief as it relates to fuel cost. We'll better manage our demurrage, but we don't expect significant improvements on, on the supply chain. We do have a new transportation management platform in place. It gives us better real-time data, better insights into decisions we can make around how we're utilizing our supply chain. We expect, not unlike we saw in 22, that we'll get the continued strength in the demand market. In the demand market, you'll see in our financials, we are expecting some improvement year over year. A significant part of this is driven by our Scottish distilling project. So we'll have the full amount of incremental capacity coming online. We have 22,000 online today. We'll get an additional capacity to roll on in our fiscal Q2, so January 1st. So we'll get a good uplift from that piece in 2023. And the last piece, our transformation efforts, which you've all heard about, a continuation of our transformation benefits. They're delivering returns today. I think we told you in 2022 we were behind our expectation of what that would deliver. I fully expect that we'll get to the $30 million run rate when we get to 2024. I have confidence in that. So on the medium term, I want to put some numbers behind what we talked about. And we're starting with fiscal year 2019, as you can see here on the far left. The reason we want to start with that is it was a pre-COVID situation. So obviously it's a very different world today, as was 22. It was a very different world than it was in 19. So a couple different pieces. As you know, the continual theme is the fact that the crop quality had a significant impact on our EBITDA, substantial downward pressure. The freight and energy piece, so supply chain, all of the other pieces that in industries like ours that rely heavily on rail and fuel costs, et cetera, timely delivery of our product, we had the same impact, certainly had a negative effect. We had a sales mix that also impacted our financials. As we stood the United Malt Group up on its own, inevitably additional corporate costs we had to incur. Our insurance costs, frankly, were more expensive than we expected to. Since then, we've been able to manage some of those down. But that drove our cost structure up pretty significantly and impacted our EBITDA. That said, in spite of the difficult headwinds, we have had a couple pieces where we have delivered better EBITDA. Our Scottish expansion is always going to be a highlight of that, and we've gotten benefit, and we'll continue to get that benefit in the future for a significant investment. And as I mentioned before, we're getting that transformation realization. So that's giving us real efficiencies across the organization, both as it relates to cost of goods sold and also in the SG&A area as well. Many of those are built into our forecast for 2023. So as the chart indicates, 2022, the low point, I don't think any of us in the room are particularly happy with that, but I want to point out a couple of key pieces that we believe will give us a lift to get to what we believe is our 2023 result. The first piece is the crop quality. As Mark had mentioned before, that crop in North America is being harvested. So with every day, the risk is already, I believe, low. With every given day, the risk gets lower and lower, that we won't have to import, and we'll have a good grasp on what our barley costs are. And I think in the finance organization, to highlight our forecasting improvements, that being the most significant piece of our financial performance. And last year, the piece that was most volatile, I think we've done our homework, and I have more confidence that we have our hands around our barley costs going forward. The other piece, as I mentioned before, is our Scottish expansion. So we expect another $10 million of EBITDA for our Scottish expansion. No real changes to our assumptions. It seems to be, with the exception being delayed, it's on track to delivering both the quantity and the volume we expected, and then still continuing to see strong demand in that area as well. We're still going to expect transformation benefit. This is the benefit we expect to capture from our transformation benefits. This, you should take comfort in knowing that this forecast was built from a bottoms-up level. There are no top-level type of adjustments. So from a CFO's point of view, I have comfort that everything that's in the forecast is built from the contract and the barley cost contract level. So I've never been a fan of adding any kind of off-the-cuff initiatives or efficiencies on the top, and so this is the piece of transformation that's in there. I want to make sure we're very specific about that. So most of those are carryover into 2024. So we'll be far better at our pricing process. We're getting better at today. We'll get better and better at our discipline around that. So we expect that new muscle to continue to give us benefit. We'll have the full year reversal of the crop impact. Obviously, we're in a volatile business, but we do expect that'll continue in 2024. Our Scottish run rate, obviously, that's a long-term investment, so we expect that to continue to pay dividends going into the future. I want to touch quickly on one of the other big movements, big changes in our financials year over year, and that is the fact that as we come off the Scottish expansion, which drove the high point in our capital expenditure since the company is, has been formed, that project will roll off, and we'll be back to a $55 to $60 million CapEx level. Without this significant pull on our cash flow, this is one of the pieces that Mark talked about to free up more cash flow and improve our ratios. My team, as I mentioned before, but it's worth mentioning again, I think it was one of the most critical functions that finance should and can perform in an organization, and that is making sure that we have high confidence analyses around all of our capital expenditures so that we can step back, ensure ourselves it's going to give us a level of return. I think there's an important element here as well that it helps all of us, helps hold all of us accountable to make sure that when we have cost assumptions and revenue and pricing assumptions that we're able to meet or exceed those expectations or take any kind of corrective action to make sure we're getting the return we're looking for. So a couple things I think you should take away from this. We do expect market conditions to be better. Obviously, that's not all in our control. But one thing we can control is the level of discipline. I think this has been a good learning year for us. We recognize the importance of having good discipline. And for me, I think that's one of the pieces that finance adds. We're analytical. We have data. We're good at keeping the organization focused on the right things. You're going to see, and we're going to manage to a lower level of growth capital. This will take close partnership, mainly between me and our COO, Tiago, to make sure that we're funding the right places and making sure we're taking care of our most critical needs across our operation. We do expect that our net debt to EBITDA ratio will return back to our target range of 2 to 2.5. And as I mentioned before, the key metrics are going to do that is an improved cash position through lower CapEx, and then our improved EBITDA that we expect in, it's really the second half of 2023 and then into 2024 as well. And then lastly, we will expect, and I am confident that we'll get the EBITDA uplift starting in 2023, and then that'll continue into 2024. So Mark and I will have a seat here, and you can and take some questions.
All right. Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate it. So we have some traveling mics, and we also have people online. So,
thanks. G'day, Mark and Ryan. It's Apoorv Sehgal here from UBS Research. Can I just ask a few questions on slide 17 with that earnings bridge, please? Just firstly, the 54.5. The crop impact, is that related to the initial number that I think was 20 to 25 before, and then now it's 54.5, is that right?
That is correct, yes. That really represents the degradation we experienced in our crop impact, yes, that's correct.
And also includes the $8 million on volume would be attached to that as well. So that's the change, if you add those up versus what we came up with guidance this time around, is one is the further deterioration in terms of the quality. We also had made some assumptions that were erroneous, and that is we thought the supply chains were going to get better and improve. And case in point would be on the rail. When we were out at the interim results, there call it 4 to 6 weeks behind. Today, they're 8 to 10 weeks behind, so it's actually gotten worse, which has had a big impact on how we operate. We've had some facilities running out of malt barley that we've had to bring in from other sources. We've had some of them running out of malt that we've had to ship from some other areas. So it's just a combination of all of those issues going on that really has created further deterioration for us and led to the 100 to 108 million forecast.
Got it. And then the green bar, 34.0, the 9-month reversal, presumably that's related to the 54.5, but isn't 9, like 3/4 of 54.5 is like 40, I think? So I'm just wondering, why is it 34?
So it is, why is it 34 versus the 50?
Yeah, isn't the 34 is related to the 54.5, right?
Yes.
But you're saying
yes.
9 months?
Yes. So the difference here is we'll still have some hangover. And this is not only the crop impact. This is also our pricing structure as well. So we'll have, those are annual contracts compared, so calendar year contracts compared to our fiscal year. Mm-hmm. So we won't get the full benefit of that for the fiscal year. So there'll be a quarter we'll still have that negative impact.
Yeah.
And then we'll have 3/4 of our fiscal year we'll have the full benefit of the impact.
Yeah, I guess, sorry, I'm just on the maths though. Shouldn't it be 3/4 of 54.5 is 40, not 34?
Yeah, yes, but there's some of the
okay.
pricing piece in there as well.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, yep.
And then just with the Scottish expansion, the 10, my understanding was it was meant to be 18 mil incremental, but 9 months of contribution, so I thought it might be 13.5 rather than 10.
There's some ramp up time as the facility comes online. So it is, and will be 3 months, 3/4, but it won't be exactly on the first day of the quarter.
And the other thing approved. So it's 18 million total project that
right.
included Arbroath as well as Erminence. So Arbroath has operated on a full year inside United Malt. Which is approximately $5 million. So if you take the $5 million off of the 18, that leaves you $13 million, and then you have 3/4 of the year of that $13 million. So that's how you come out with roughly a $10 million incremental improvement in 23.
Okay. And then that sales mix of 8.5, is that to do with the specialty versus base malt and how that's been a bit suboptimal through COVID with the gross margins?
Do you know, I believe, that was a little before my time.
So,
I believe, yes, that is.
So that's a component. And it also gets into a little bit of the customer optimization. And so I'd made mention of the fact that we've been having to ship out of different areas. We've been having to supply some of our customers out of Montreal, as an example, because they had availability quality. So there's a little bit more to it than just the specialty mix. There's a little bit more in there. We're still behind 19 on the specialty percentage inside the business. We're anticipating that we will get that all back in FY23, and it's a kind of an interesting thing to talk about in the next session, getting people like Brian Bichard to weigh in on that in terms of that craft demand that switches that mix around for us.
Okay. And just last question. If I'm then trying to take the next step and thinking about, okay, let's build a bridge at 24. So if we start with a 140 to 160 in FY23, should we presumably add about 20 mil for that crop impact? Because you're saying 54.5, then it becomes 34, but then there's still 20 left to do, another 3 months the next year. So you've got plus 20. And then in a sort of the optimistic case, plus 20 the transformation benefits. Hopefully you go from 10 to 30 and 24 is another 20 million incremental there. And then with Scotland, you're saying we go from, there's still 3 mil left, I think you said. So 13 mil is left to do, but 10 mil happens. So I've got a plus 20, a plus 20, a plus 3. So if my maths is right, we get sort of 183 to 203 in FY24. But then on top of that, the sales mix, the 8.5, there might be something there that comes back, hopefully, if the mix sort of normalizes. So is that kind of the right way to think about it?
Yeah, you're touching the key components and why we feel good about where FY24 and beyond will go. Not yet ready to say that we think that's what it is, but you're hitting the key factors of where we think there'll be continued improvement that goes beyond FY23.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for taking the questions.
Thank you.
Thanks. John Campbell from Jefferies. Just a couple of questions. Firstly, Ryan, just on the ERP implementation, I mean, we've all heard sort of horror stories around Oracle implementations and the like in the past, and I guess, you know, people are always nervous and worried about these things because obviously UMG's putting a lot of faith in what this can deliver. Can you just give us a update on that and what risks you perceive there in terms of delivery?
Sure, I can talk about the finance piece and to some extent on the delivery piece. I'll turn it over to Mark as well. So we'll have a pretty significant we'll get some lift in our EBITDA this next year in 2023 as that expense starts to roll off. So we expect $6 million versus the $13 million that we had in 2022. So we'll get some benefit. Our CIO is highly confident that we're going to be able to deliver to that at that level. We just had a go live in our warehousing business, I believe this week. So, so starting to implement that, we're starting to, roll across the organization with a couple different scheduled pieces, so we're able to kind of learn as we go. I don't know, Mark, anything to add to that?
And then on the processing side, we'll be delivered end of March 2023. Right. As part of the ERP, John, is that's a financial component, but the other component for us is that it's really putting data in a way that is real time. I think Tiago likes to talk about it as being it's one source of truth. We're dealing with multiple systems here and trying to collect it together. This one will be that one source of truth and real time. So there's benefits that come in just from the decision making aspect of things that we're really looking forward to, very honestly.
Thanks for that. And just back to the contract structures, and obviously barley, barley volumes, barley quality is obviously both of those things have impacted. And the difficulty that you've had in passing those costs, those additional costs through to customers. But just touching on the barley quality side of things, are you broadly saying to us under the new contract structures that regardless of the quality of the crop, I mean, given that it's something that's totally outside your control and you shouldn't bear the risk for that, regardless of quality of crop, you will be compensated for additional costs to deliver the required quality and volumes to customers. So in future, we shouldn't expect barley quality to be a downgrade issue.
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked the question because I just want to clarify exactly what I'm talking about in the dynamic pricing. It is for us to make the decision when we transfer across on price. And that's not just supply, and it's not just where barley prices are at. It's about certainty and having both supply and quality. And so we have purposely not just slowing down how we price our malt contracts, but only incremental tonnage that we can put in. So as we see the crop getting better, not just in supply, but also quality, then we start increasing what type of percentage that we sell. So case in point, we're sitting here this year where we've got 70% of our business all locked in. That means we've got 30% still open that we're using as, in essence, a natural hedge against any supply or quality issues that can turn up. And then that will get reflected in what your price is that you would sell the malt on a go-forward basis. Now, with that, going through 22, one of the benefits, and sometimes we've got to look hard to see what the benefits are, but there has been a major change in terms of our relationship with a lot of our customers. They're starting to understand this is a mutual dependence. We're here to supply them to the best capabilities we can, but then they're understanding much better of why they have to participate in how we work through that. So we're getting more flexibility in some of the quality characteristic terms. They're getting better at learning how to work with that because they had to out of necessity in 2022. So I think just in that element of that more mutual type of consideration in itself will help reduce the quality exposure that we have been taking on.
Thanks. And just the last question from me. The piece that's obvious, we've already touched on it, but the piece that's difficult for us to know anything about is the extent of the mix shift back to craft, and you've previously said that margins on craft and boutique and micro brewers is substantially higher than for mainstream mass volume brewers. So obviously that potentially is a very big factor. Can you just give us a little bit more quantification, if you can, on where we are in that shift back to the, you know, the historic pre-COVID mix? Thank you.
Yeah, and so that's a commercial type of question. So what we've been seeing in behavior on the craft guys, and again, Brian can talk to this a more detailed base, so just keep in mind on the question. So when we have him in the session, he can go through it. The behavior that we're seeing out of the craft is that the business is coming back, and as the on-premise opens up, we're seeing that come back in. So the volumes are picking up and are getting back really close to pre-COVID-19 levels. But what we are seeing out of the craft producer is they're not producing the array of sometimes 12 to 15 types of beers, and a lot of the customized beers take that specialty malt. And we think they're doing that for a couple of reasons. One is they're still tentative to see if this back to return in demand is there. And it also allows them to operate, I would just say, a little bit more efficiently. And considering that their costs have gone up, labor is tight, that we think that's affecting some of that behavior and why that hasn't fully expanded. The other issue I'd say is on our big customers that also buy some specialty malt, that we're seeing that start to come back. We're trying to understand at this point, is that just a Northern Hemisphere summer issue, and then will that go back down again? Or if that is actually a fundamental, what I'll call normalization that's going on. So we look for that to improve. I'm not here in a position to be able to tell you that I think it totally improves, because there's just more to see before we could forecast that.
So it's uncertain whether that is going to be a positive drive into FY24. You've given us guidance for 23, but whether we should add something for that factor in is uncertain.
So confident that we see as the 8.5, my concern that we see on a go-forward basis is, does that turn into something that we can say is an additional driver to what we've got forecasted.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Thanks, Mark. It's Simon Conn from Investors Mutual. Can you talk to, I mean, obviously we're forecasting improvements, but can you talk to the dynamic? I mean, obviously you're providing a commodity to a producer who's making a very high margin. So in a market that's short, you're quite valuable to them. And when we have a good crop, can you just talk to the disciplines, the processes and procedures that are going to make you just sure that we get this sort of aspirational target of circa 200? Because obviously in that environment, they don't need you so much. And you've just talked before how the last 10 years you've tried to merge terms and margin back to them, and you got bitten on the bum in this environment. So can we just get some confidence around the disciplines, A, that the business has internally, I think you've talked about that a bit, Ryan, but B, also the market dynamics and why they need you in a good environment, if you feel like. And if you look at page 4 in the presentation, you've got the locations of your plants. Obviously, some of your customers are vertically integrated to some extent. So I'm just trying to understand, are you a swing producer for these guys, and that when things are good, they won't need you? If freight normalises, your dynamics, you know, your market position deteriorates. Can you just talk to that dynamic and give us some confidence that, you know, in when a market the way barley is plentiful and quality is good, that you can actually generate high returns?
Yeah. No, I appreciate the question, Simon. So there's two issues that we're trying to not just fix but actually enhance with the contractual terms that we've changed. First one is about the risk, right? So it's getting your costs across and rebalancing the risk curve between the user and ourselves. And quite honestly, the situation we have in front of us is making that easier to do. And the reasons for that is just because security of supply. So when we talk about malt barley, then we start taking a look at the malt side of the equation, that's actually even tighter than what we see from the malt barley side. And it's getting tighter in other areas, along with supply chain costs, is raising it a lot. Brian will talk about what's happening in his business as an example, and where imported European malts that he's using are becoming prohibitively expensive, which is creating opportunities for us from the North American side. Now when I talk about the big brewers, there's no question we're in a better position just because of the tightness of supply. So I think your question is, so is that something we can hang on to? Is that something, what are we building into our pricing decisions? That's a fundamental change that we're doing in the discipline, and I'll go a lot to what Ryan said, and that is that tracking that and understanding the decisions that we're making, are they adhering to where we look at how the margin should improve, and then also managing the risk. So this may sound like a crude way to say it is, but instead of flying somewhat blind or intuitively how you're looking at that, that this is being tracked contract by contract, customer by customer. So we are looking at how we can affect that margin improvement, understand what our market share is, and understand any advantages we have with our competitors. So we're not needlessly giving away on margin just because we're concerned about what the supply needs to be. If we have a customer that inherently is advantaged by buying from us, well, then we should be capturing a portion of that benefit and not giving it away to the customer. And that's a whole commercial process. It's a process that Tiago's group is involved in with the supply and operation processes they put in place. So to his point, we've got all disciplines sitting there on a weekly basis as we're looking at decisions. So we've got commercial, we have operations, we have finance, and we have logistics. And that is a big component of where the transportation management system comes into place as well, so that we can truly understand not only what our costs are, but we can see what the costs are in from different locations, competitors.
And follow-up question, just on these new contracts, you've talked about margin and earnings, but can you talk about working capital? Obviously, the receivables balance that you run is pretty ridiculous and speaks to the imbalance between your bargaining position and theirs. So can we expect some improvements there?
Yeah, we're working on getting the terms down because I would agree with you. We don't want to be a bank. And so the most basic way of doing that is negotiating shorter terms. And the other way to look at it is also is then maybe there's just a factoring component in there that we have to factor off. Right. But in either case, there's a cost element in there. So we need to make sure that we are covering the cost. So if we're extending 180-day terms or 120-day terms, then we need to make sure that that credit is getting priced in appropriately into the margin and making that very clear and obvious to the customer that if you want us to accept those types of terms, here's the additive margin that's going to have to go into place. And when I talk about additive margin, again, we don't want to be a bank, so it's not just taking interest rate at 2% and saying we're going to tack it in. It's really more about you're consuming a component of the capacity on our balance sheet. So it has to have really more of a rate of return to it that mimics what our finite capacity is in our balance sheet. So we're making some headway. But the bigger ones are sitting in these LTAs that we've got a couple-year process in front of us to try to get those terms shortened.
So does the CFA's KPIs include working capital and getting better returns?
Absolutely.
The last question for me. You talked about CapEx of 55 to 60. I stay in business 30 to 35. But given the balance sheet, why spend 20 to 25 million on growth CapEx?
And we'll take a look at it, because I'll answer the question from more of a tactical aspect. You can answer sure. it on the financial, yeah. what the impact is for us. But we are putting that out there and saying for the next 2 to 3 years, we would look at that's the type of spend we would have. What we do in 23 may not necessarily be at that level. But I've also got Tiago taking a look at our plants and saying, are there some continuous improvement projects that will actually give us higher rates of return? And I don't want to, I'm not going to say not just slow it down. I want to make sure that we're getting the right priorities where we're spending the capital. So I'm comfortable living inside that $60 million. If we have a year like 23 where we're saying, well, maybe that 50 million is the only ones that have the right priorities to them, then it'll be 50 million.
Yeah, and I'd say from a finance point of view, I'd say exactly the same thing. It doesn't. I don't think of this as an affordability piece that we need to fill. I think I would view it, we would look at projects that will give us that level of return, and at that point we'd stop spending capital. So if it's less than 55, 60, then we wouldn't fund anything more than that.
Thanks.
Thank you. Good morning. David Perbucky from Macquarie. Thanks for hosting us today. Just a question in terms of how the contracts are staggered. Do you have confidence that 100% of the contracts will be successfully renegotiated? And do you think that'll happen so you get the full benefit by the end of FY24?
Yeah, I have confidence that we will get these fully negotiated. And confidence comes, David, from a couple areas. One is the conversations that we're having on contracts that will be coming up for renewal, that we have laid out the changes. And quite honestly, it's not just the fact that it's a security of supply issue, but I think there's an acknowledgement that that balance of where the risk is assumed has just moved away from where it should go, particularly when we look at some of the risks that are being absorbed in previous contracts. That's a type of risk that we can't manage well, but the customer can. So there's a natural shift that should go on with that. And the conversations we've had with our big brewers, they're acknowledging that. I'll give you a couple examples, and that is from a freight component. We've gone back to two of our major customers and saying that this is just literally not what this was set up to do. And they have agreed and have already made changes on existing contract, not waiting for the renewable. So that tells us that they're understanding this and that the balance is out. And the other component, quite honestly, and you'll see it on Tiago's presentation, is that the industry as a whole in North America is operating at a very high utilization rate. And I think our big customers acknowledge that they need to make sure that we are being successful enough that if we need to be making further investments into our plants or capacity in the future, that we're going to have to see that there's a reward for driving capital into those type of investments.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think we'll probably have to call a time. Let's take a break, get a coffee, and if you have any questions, we can see if we can pick them up on the second session. And try to answer them, then we have a better idea how much time we have left. So thank you very much, and we'll come back in 10 minutes, so about 5:02.
Okay. Well, welcome back. We'll get started up right away. We've still got a lot to go through, and apologize kind of cutting the question short, but again, we can try to give some more time on the back end here for Q&A. I mean, that's why we're here, is try to answer your questions. So I just want to go through strategy just rather quickly for me, because I think you need to hear from the people that are actually driving and executing the strategy. So I'll keep this very short. My main message is that, you know, the three pillars that we're working on are very applicable. We don't see any structural change. That doesn't mean we haven't reprioritized some of the projects that we're executing on. But optimizing the core is a phenomenally important component for us. This is a big driver for, if I think of it operationally, that Tiago's got his team working through and restacking and looking for new initiatives that I would say that would be quicker to execute and drive some improvements to the bottom line in a pretty quick manner. You heard Ryan talking about Transform Tomorrow. You're going to see it inside of both the operational groups in terms of what that means and what they're driving on it. And they're also going to spend time talking about what they can create for value. The net result is we still end up, I'm going to come back to that, we still end up with a financial capital allocation framework that we're holding ourselves accountable to. This is a commitment that we have, and some of the financial drivers and what that means for return of value to shareholders. At the end of the day, You're the owners, and that's what we got to make sure that we're providing. So those are the big key components. You're going to see more of us benchmarking ourselves against this framework. I know that Ryan is really concentrating on best ways for us to be able to display this. I'd say for one thing, when Graham had brought up understanding what's going on more in frequency, it's really you know, pushing that scorecard forward so they can see what's happening and understand what our change or course correction that we're going to do to be able to stay on a track. The final thing that I wanted to mention, because again, you're going to see this coming through, is that we're very committed to a sustainable business. And this is something that you can talk about sustainability, but you know, how are we going to make that happen? And that's the part that these guys will be able to bring that to life for you between Brian and Tiago. So with that, I'm going to hand it off to you, Tiago, and you can go through processing. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mark. Good morning. Excited to be here. I'm Tiago De Rocha, and I'll be taking you through the processing part of the presentation. Important to start to say that obviously 22 has been a very disappointing year, has been a very difficult year, as we've had to reverse the supply chain in order to bring in barley into Canada. Not only has it impacted our bottom line due to the higher costs that we've discussed, but obviously just looking at my team from the actual execution of it, it has been very complicated as we had to literally bring boats into Canada, reverse our supply chain in order to get grain into Canada successfully. But with that, just like any other, when you work through issues, when you work through adversities, you come out stronger. And I truly believe I'm a big process person. I'll give you my background a little bit. But I truly believe that we're building stronger processes. We certainly learned a lot through this. And we're building stronger processes, and we've come out much stronger. And I think we're really building some of the important building blocks for the future of UMG. With that, let me give you a little bit of my background, my professional background, and tie that to why I'm excited about the future of UMG and some of the things that I believe we can do. So I had the privilege to work for Anheuser-Busch InBev. As you hope you guys know, it's the biggest brewer in the world, for 21 years. I started as a sophomore when this was my second year of engineering school, and I've been there up until a year ago when I came to work for UMG. I spent 13 years at plants, so literally deep into the plants, started on the ground floor working with the brewers, and then worked through different positions, including manager of engineering. I was a brewmaster for 2 years, and I was plant manager for a couple of years also. After those 13 years at plants, I went to corporate where I managed multi-sites. I had the opportunity to spend 2 years in a finance section for U.S. and Canada. I had budgeting and performance management responsibilities of about $5.1 billion of spend for U.S. and Canada, so it was the COGS line for the P&L for U.S. and Canada. And I had the opportunity then to move to Mexico as vice president of operations. In there, Mexico is the Grupo Modelo, is a subsidiary of Anheuser-Busch InBev in that area. And in there, I went with a team that took ABI's ways of working into the Grupo Modelo operation, so we operationalized the ABI's ways of working in there. And then my last role, I was Global Vice President of Brewing and Quality. Brewing, about 300 breweries throughout the world, and quality, when you factor in the vertical operations, there's about 350 sites that overall were under my responsibility. So if you think through that, obviously it takes a very disciplined management system, both in technically and also from a managerial aspect, to be able to manage that. And I've seen firsthand the power that a strong management system has. I've seen what good looks like, and I'm excited to bring that to UMG. We do have quite a bit of opportunity to operate more as a team with best practices, and that's what I've been working on for the past year and excited to continue to work into the future. So with that, what I'll be doing today is I'll take you through quickly, give you a very quick overview on the market, mainly reinforce some of the points that were made earlier. I have one quick slide to talk a little bit about our value chain, which I think is important, and how we add value. And then I'll spend more time talking about our strategy and connecting back to the point that Mark made with respect to strategy.
So let me talk very quickly about the market, and again, reinforces some of the points that were made earlier. We continue to see growth in overall beer sales. The overall CAGR for 5 years is about 4.2%. And in the more mature markets, what we continue to see is the shift to craft. And we also have a very strong presence there, so I think we're very well set up there. And Brian will talk about that on his side of the presentation. From the whiskey front, it's the same story. And we continue to see, we see a CAGR of about 3%. That's what the forecast is. And as Mark mentioned, as an example of that, 80% of our capacity for Inverness is already sold. And then the last important piece, you can see on this graph that the overall asset utilization for malting is quite high throughout the world, and specifically in the areas where we operate. So with these in mind, you can see that that continues to give us a favorable environment to operate into the future. Let me show you a video about our process, and this is the Pinkenba plant here in Australia.
In 2011, United Malt built a state-of-the-art malting facility in the Brisbane suburb of Pinkenba. This fully automated facility was built to produce malt in the climate conditions of southeast Queensland. The site has the capacity to produce 100,000 tonnes of malt annually for domestic and export customers, who include major breweries on the east coast of Australia and across Southeast Asia. Malt is barley grain that's been germinated and then dried. It involves a precise three-step process of steeping, germination, and kilning. This modified grain malt contains important components such as starch, sugars, and enzymes. It's produced to the brewer's unique specifications. The first production step is steeping, where the cleaned barley kernel is immersed in aerated water. This raises the moisture level and promotes germination. The entire process is remotely monitored via a control room. The next step is to transfer the barley to three germination vessels. The vessels are temperature and humidity controlled to ensure even germination. The barley is also regularly turned to allow for adequate airflow. In the final stage, the green malt is transferred to a kiln for drying over 24 hours. This stops the germination process, imparts colour and flavour, and prepares the malt for long-term storage. Heat recovery systems are used to optimise energy usage. Waste is also minimised, all rootlet captured and sold for animal feed. Robots are used to high-pressure clean the germination vessels. Truck drivers self-operate the malt loading, delivered to customers 24 hours, 7 days a week, in bulk by truck or container. Malt adds a particular flavour and colour to whiskey, beer and food products. Malting is one of the most fascinating yet least celebrated steps of the brewing and distilling process.
Okay, beautiful video, and this is a really exciting part. That's what makes me really excited about what I do every day. So love the operations. Let me tell you a little bit about how we create value and our value chain. So it all starts with the selection of the highest quality barley. Mother Nature gives us every year natural variability of the grain, and the highly knowledgeable teams, highly experienced teams that we have in place play a critical role in making sure that we're selecting the best barley, the barley that's going to meet the criteria for our customers. They look at what's in the field, what's available. They work very closely with our plants, which I'll talk about in a little bit here, because we have levers in our plant that we can pull that combine, taking in the quality and then levers that we can adjust in the process to, and this is where we add an incredible amount of value, is to create a very consistent input to the brewers. Having been a brewer, having worked at a brewery for a long time, and the criticality of this consistent input in the malt is key. And this is where our teams come in, and this is where the experience that our maltsters have plays a critical role. This year, with a very difficult Canadian crop, and U.S. too, but specifically in Canada, the impact that our teams have had to deliver quality, consistent product, despite all the challenges, despite all the different difficulties that we've had with the crop, has added a tremendous amount of value to United Malt. And I'll tell you that, despite all the issues, there hasn't been one single major quality complaint or quality issue from our customers. So we've been able to work through with our teams and deliver quality malt. The second big step is around storage and preservation. So barley has several different varieties. Lots of our brewers and lots of our distillers have specific needs as far as which barleys or which barley varieties they accept. So we need to be able to preserve and we should be able to segregate. And also on the storage piece, because if you think about it, the harvest happens in a period of weeks, yet we utilize the barley and we process the barley and deliver malt throughout the year. So the storage component is a very important part, and the ability to preserve the quality during that storage period is paramount. The processing piece is what you saw the video. This is where the magic happens. This is where a lot of the truly exciting piece of our process takes place. And again, I want to reemphasize the high quality, the experience of our maltsters played a key role here. I always say, just like brewing malt, this is a little bit of a mix of art and science. And I think the piece of the experience and the art that our teams have with their history and time with our company have played a very big role here. And last but not least, from the distribution standpoint, we deliver via trucks and we deliver via trains and we export via containers. Let me tie back to the strategy that Mark talked about and where we're focused on. So the three key areas is optimizing the core, transforming for tomorrow, and creating value. So when it comes to optimizing the core, I'll talk a little bit about the expansion of where we are with the Scottish capacity expansion up north. I'll talk about transformation itself and where we are, and a lot of that is about data. I'll touch base on ESG. We want to make ESG an important part of how we operate. And then we have some important new technology, some transformational step change technology that we're implementing that I'm excited to take you through also. So first off is the Scottish capacity expansion. As mentioned previously in the discussions today, we believe we invested at the right time as the demand is there. And again, just to repeat the fact here, about 80% of our capacity for this new expansion is already sold. Our growth is already in line, and it's actually over-delivering to the business case by about 3,000 metric tons per year. And then Inverness is in progress, and we have line of sight on the project schedule to have the plant delivering and making malt by the end of the year. This has been a very difficult project. It has been we've executed it in the middle of COVID and through Brexit, and you can imagine the challenges that we had to deal with. The team's fully committed. I touch base with the team every week on where we are. In some cases, I've engaged directly with some of the engineering firms that we're working with. And again, it's been complex, but we're towards the end, and we have good line of sight on the startup before the end of the year. When it comes to transforming our business, three main areas that I want to discuss. One is organizational design. I'll talk about process change, and I'll talk about operations management. From an organizational redesign standpoint, we spent really the last year combining the management practices of our operations in the U.S. and Canada. This is where we had quite a bit of opportunity for synergies between the teams. And really, when you look at the operating structure, we were able to simplify. We're able to push down decision-making to our experts. We're able to drive accountability, and we're able to really focus on performance. From a process change standpoint, Mark already mentioned, but we strengthened our sales and operations meetings and routines. This is where the sales team comes together with the operations team, logistics, and finance, and the procurement team to make decisions and make good decisions using data when it comes to supply and how we're managing our inventory. And I'll make the point that between the Canadian and U.S. operations combination and the sales and operations planning upgrades that we've made this year, they've been fundamental to the successful reversal of our supply chain and successfully importing the barley into Canada, which has been a very complex process. We're also focused on new technology implementation. Again, Mark and Ryan already talked about it. We're focused on the ERP, and this will be our one source of truth for data. This is one area that I'm truly excited about because we'll be able to make better decisions more rooted on data faster, to unlock value from the business. So I'm excited once we have everything in one place and can really use data to drive that. And then we're in the process of implementing our ERP, our TMS system, transportation management system. Well, we have visibility that today we don't have into our transportation assets. And we truly believe that we can unlock quite a bit of value from there, too, once we have a much better view of the data, where our assets are, and we believe there's a lot of optimization that's possible there. When it comes to operations management, we're working to see how we can operate more as a network of plants in order to optimize the delivery cost of our malt. And then we're heavily focused, and we're just starting what I'm calling the United Malt ways of working. And this ties back to the point I made earlier when I introduced myself and I talked about my past professional experience, and this is really where we're setting ourselves up to operate using best practices, using benchmarking between our sites and externally so that we can drive performance. Again, this is best practices both from a managerial standpoint as well as technical, because when we look into our plants, and I'm having the opportunity to visit our plants throughout the world, we do have experts in throughout the world, and each of them have different backgrounds, different history of malting, and I think there's a lot of opportunity to harmonize that between our sites. ESG, we want to continue to make ESG an important part of how we operate and on the environment piece, and I'm happy to say we made some good progress this past year. On sustainable agriculture, we're very close to being able to work with all of our partners throughout the world, our farmer partners and those that we buy grain from, to utilize the Sustainable Agriculture Initiative platform that measures adherence to the best practices in farming. So we'll be able to measure that, we'll be able to see where the gaps are, and we'll be able to work with them to drive improvements. And again, this is a win-win for our farmers, for the environment, and for our company. From a waste, energy, and water standpoint, we've been working on benchmarking, understanding where we are and where the opportunities are. When it comes to waste, we believe we should end this year with a reduction of roughly 5% versus last year. And when it comes to energy and water, two important projects, again, using technology, two important projects that we're driving this year. First off is a cogen that's an $8 million project, a Canadian dollar project that we implemented in our Canadian operation in Calgary, thank you, in our Calgary operation. And that's been very successful. It's a 3.3 megawatt turbine that's running. It's about 80% of the plant's energy production, and we're saving roughly a little bit over $300,000 in electricity per month, and the project is delivering very well. So, again, very successful project. And then next is I'll talk a little bit about OptiSteep. This is exciting new technology that it's changing how we malt, and I'll cover that on the next slide here. But this is super super exciting. So OptiSteep is a water technology that basically it's a water purification system, water filtration system. So our steeping portion of our process uses a tremendous amount of water. And this system, instead of normal malting, I should say historical malting, you just take the new water in and the water that's wastewater, you dump it. In this case, you take this wastewater and you send it through this advanced oxidation system that comes back into the steeping process. So you don't need to bring as much new water in. The advanced oxidation itself improves the oxidation of the barley, of the kernels. So that drives for improved quality. And what we're seeing in the results, we had this unit installed in our Pocatello plant in one of the malt houses in our Pocatello plant. And we're seeing about a 30% overall reduction in water usage. That's very substantial. The investment was about $2.6 million, relatively easy to implement. We implemented in about a year. And we are working through customer acceptance right now, and the preliminary results are very positive. They are also excited about the ESG and the water reduction possibilities of this technology. And as soon as we continue to prove it out, the plan is to continue to roll this out to our other plants. And just to summarize the processing piece or the processing segment of the conversation here, as I mentioned, lots of focus on the Scottish distilling and the startup of the Inverness plant. So the team in the UK is super dedicated, super focused on getting this started up by the end of the year, and we have line of sight into our project schedule and how to deliver that. We continue to be heavily focused on the transformation initiatives, and again, here's all around data and this, what the new systems are going to bring to us in terms of data and allow us to make better decisions. And then lastly, we're continuing to look for opportunities to leverage our assets, both from a technological standpoint, for example, OptiSeq that I talked about, but also utilizing the United Malt ways of working, which will give us the ability to benchmark and improve our operations and therefore unlock value. So with that, I'd like to pass the presentation over to my colleague, Brian. Thank you.
Thank you. If you can go to my first slide. Good morning, everyone, and I apologize. I'm not there today with you. But certainly look forward to meeting many of you in the not too distant future. I'm going to start by giving you an overview of where and how our warehouse distribution business operates. From there, I'll talk to our value proposition, where we see risk and growth opportunities, strategic priorities for warehouse and distribution, why and how we are participating in the Mexican craft market, how WD is participating in overall United Malt's transformation initiatives, and talk a little bit about our results. I'll talk to ESG and what we're doing from a warehouse and distribution front, and then I'll talk to innovation. And then finally, I'll talk about our results and continued areas of focus going forward. We can go to the next slide, please. So in North America, CMG is how we go to business. That's Country Malt Group. We have 13 distribution sites. One of them is a satellite site for us, a 3PL in Nova Scotia, Canada. The rest of them we manage ourselves with our own people. We have two packaging locations on the eastern in the east coast of the U.S. and on the west coast, as well as at Canna Malting's plant in Calgary. All our sites have the ability to tote, and by tote I mean put malt into half ton or one ton bags. We can custom blend recipes for our customers as well, and we have mailing capabilities. At Cryer Malt, that's how we go to business in Australia and New Zealand. We have five distribution sites. Cryer was established in 1991. I forgot to mention Country Malt was originally established in 1995. Now with five distribution sites, the reason we're able to do that is we've opened up our first self-managed site in Victoria earlier this year. That site has bagging capabilities, toting, and custom blending capabilities. And if the market enables us opportunity, we will put in milling capabilities at that site. Prior to opening that up earlier this year, we were operating eight third-party facilities. So this enabled us to consolidate, offer better customer experience through managing that ourselves, so we can act at the speed of the customer, and we're able to cover 65% of the market out of that location. Next slide, please. So looking at the circle callouts, and all of these tie to one key component of our business, and that is focus on being easy to do business with. We know it drives customer loyalty and an opportunity to gain more share of wallet from customers. So we talk about each one online experience. What we want is to enable the customer to engage with us on her timeline. That means if they want to place an order at 3 in the morning because that works best for them, well, they should certainly be able to do so. They want to track contract balances, look at old invoices, certainly should be enabled to do so, as well as track their freight and transit. When you put the other three together, how we function is more as a grocery store for our customers. We are a house of brands. We sell not only United Malt brands, but we also represent multiple other maltsters around the world in North America and in Australia and New Zealand. So how the grocery store works is, we don't even just sell malt. We sell hops. We sell a wide range of products, basically all possible ingredients that a brewer is going to need. We function with flat pallet prices. So the heavy product on the pallet is going to be malt. If they're able to put on hops or other ancillary products, those ride free. And it enables that one-stop shop and enables a large segment of our customers to function on a just-in-time basis. Next slide, please. So we are forecasting continued growth in the market, and I'll talk to where we see different segments and where there's opportunity and where there's not. In the U.S. presently, craft accounts for about 13% of total production through 2021. But presently in the market, we are seeing increases in economy-type beers. That's in the U.S., driven in part by inflation, but also the segment of labor seeing the highest wage increases presently is what we would typically refer to as blue collar. But craft has an opportunity here to attract this segment. There are typically beer consumers, but largely macro-produced lagers. Craft's great opportunity here is to make a less bitter, more malt-forward beer. For on-premise producers, adding and catering to different demographics by adding an NA, cider, or perhaps a seltzer to broaden their portfolio will only bring in more customers to them. And fortunately, United Malt's warehouse and distribution model is ideally suited to help them with those efforts. Next slide, please. So I was talking about where I saw growth and where I saw risk opportunities. So through COVID, primary risk wasn't as much about a lack of demand. Rather, it was more about access to customer. This fact is largely unchanged. However, the primary segment where the risk resides has changed. So the risk factor where we see the highest issue is with a group of customers that we would refer to as micros, but these micros don't have on-premise distribution. They don't have tap rooms. They're not large enough to gain economies of scale, and they use multiple distribution methods to market. We are seeing considerable consolidation amongst beer distributors in the U.S. market. The big are getting bigger, and they're abbreviating their portfolios. So that is certainly an issue that where we see risk. But on-premise is coming back. You can see on the graph on the left, the majority of brewers in that space are smaller brewers, and they count on-premise production. Why we like that so much is these brewers will make 7 to 8 times their margins by selling it through their own distribution channels versus selling it through another beer distributor angle. We go to the next market. We also like it because it's higher malt inclusion. Why is it so high? Well, typically, the brewers at these smaller segments don't have as sophisticated equipment as some of the larger brewers, but they're also making what I would consider to be bigger beers. So these bigger beers have more alcohol content and typically more hop content, which you need more malt to balance the flavor out. These customers are harder to serve, typically buy multiple brands, and they're very, very loyal to those brands. They have working capital constraints and space constraints and will rely heavily on the just-in-time model. Many of them, to reduce landed costs of their materials, don't have the ability to buy in large quantities, specifically hops, which is costly on a per-pound basis. So our model enables them to source those products on a just-in-time basis along with their malt, which they typically buy 2 to 3 times a month. There are upwards of 7,000 of them in North America, and a vast majority of them will buy or source bagged or toted malt, and that is the space that Country Malt participates in. And obviously, we believe we are ideally suited to service these types of customers. Next slide, please. So how warehouse and distribution is contributing into United Malt's overall strategy. We are working to optimize our core by expanding the reach of UMG's house of brands. And I'll talk to each of these individually on the next couple of slides. So we're also transforming for the business of tomorrow and looking for ways to be good corporate citizens and create more value and more higher returns through innovation. Next slide, please. So we'll talk about our expansion into Mexico. We saw Mexico as an ideal market for us to grow along with. It's small, very small today by comparison, but it is attractive for us because you have a growing younger population. You have an emerging middle class. There's an established beer culture, and there's a drive toward premiumization and an interest in local, which certainly fits well with craft. UMG's North American portfolio versus the imported malts positions us extremely well, not just in Mexico, but through country malt. And the reason being is we have the broadest portfolio through country malt of North American products, more than any other competitor, certainly with Canada Malting, with Great Western Malting, and with our partner, with another partner maltings that we distribute for, and that's Breese out of Chilton, Wisconsin. Imports will have a harder time getting product there. We know there's continued issues with supply chain. We know that they're going to be paying higher costs for energy. So obviously we want to grow the products within Country Malt's portfolio of imports, but we certainly offer our customers other options in the event the price gets prohibited for them. In Mexico, we have three distribution sites that enables us to cover the entirety of the market. Based out of Merida was the first. We now have site in Baja California, as well as Guadalajara. We originally were working with multiple other distributors, and we do this around the globe and work in with distributors until we see if we have shared values or shared vision for the market. When we met with BeerMex, we found that we did. Our investment mechanism with them is that of a convertible loan note. So we have the ability to use Country Malt's history and knowledge and experience to help them through this time, because we do have visibility to what is happening within that business. And we anticipate that we will convert that loan note to equity at a certain point in time, and we'll have majority ownership. That will be the mechanism that we expect to go with in other markets as they emerge similar to Mexico. Next slide, please. So warehouse of distribution started earlier on our transformation initiatives. So from 2018 forward, we were growing our top line, but we were delivering less return to the bottom line. So we did a deep dive into what we were doing to better understand why and where their opportunities were. That helped us to really see and understand that what got us to a position of leadership in the market was not going to be a position that kept us in the leadership in the market. So we're now able to focus on where our profits come from. We have much better visibility to profit by brand, by customer, by SKU, by segment. So that is very powerful for us. Couple that with market scope, our ability to understand the markets. Now, you saw on that earlier slide where I was showing the malt usage for smaller breweries. Well, each brewer in the U.S. has to pay tax, and it's public information on their production. So utilizing that information is very valuable to us. So now we not only understand what segments and what customers provide profit to us, but we also understand the full scope of different markets. So what our share is, what our share should be, and where we need to focus efforts and where we need to retain, and also where we know that it's not worth our time to focus on. Knowing that's very powerful when you couple understanding the profitability and the market scope, but alone not a solution. We needed to address skill gaps in our business, which we've done. By adding sales and supply chain leadership capabilities and address both with the tools and the processes and tools that got us to where we were, we needed to change. They were not going to be the tools and processes that took us forward. And we needed to enable our people to focus on driving profitable volume and our ease of doing business initiatives. And I can't stress the value enough. I'm very pleased that our Cryer business just went live this week. And we are dispatching and invoicing orders. on the new ERP, and Country Malt in North America will follow later this month. And but the value that will add for us to be able to be on a single platform, have standardization of process, standardization of metrics, and the ability to incentivize the right behaviors is very, very exciting to us. So on the ESG slide, the next slide, please. So warehouse and distribution isn't a large consumer of energy, but there was definitely opportunity for us to participate in this space. And where we saw the most opportunity was around trying to divert waste from landfills. So our products that we ship, or the bags that we ship our products in, are poly 5 recyclable, including the totes. But our customers, the vast majority of them, have no ability to get to scale to entice a recycler to come and pick them up. So we function as an aggregator for our customers, bail them, load them in a truck, and once it gets full, we will call the recycler to come pull that. We also do that for, we also accept competing bags back as well. And we're proud to say we've been able to divert just under 95% of our waste previously that was going to landfills. We also see opportunity with our new TMS system, the transportation management system. By better understanding our loaded versus unloaded miles for our inbound shipments, but also help customers who are larger, who can take larger shipments, to make better decisions to both reduce their landed cost of their products, but also try to use less fuel in the process. Next slide, please. So innovation. So our customers by nature are innovators. They are constantly looking for what's next. What are they gonna make next? And they like the fact that our grocery store does not stay stagnant. We are constantly looking to evolve it and add new products to it. Since 2019, what we would call ancillary, so non-hop, non-malt products, we've seen 26% compounded annual growth in those sales. So we expect that our goal is not just to be giving the customer what they ask for. We want to be ahead of the customer, constantly be looking for what's new, what can we add to that grocery store. One of the things that we have added this year is a product that we call EuroPills. You heard Tiago, Mark talk about the issues with the North American harvest and the need to import product or barley from other countries. Well, this was an opportunity for us, too, to create a new product. And that, like I said, is EuroPills. Lower in protein, lower in modification, very light in color, with a crisp, less earthy flavor that you would typically get from North American malt. And it enables that price point lower than import malt. So adding that to our portfolio, coupled with the North American portfolio of products that we have, solves problems for our customers. Again, if our customers want to stay loyal with our European brands, fantastic. We certainly want them to do that. If they're unable to, we have solutions readily available for them. Specialty ingredients, specialty non-malted, torrefied or flake products, we're talking oats, corn, wheat, barley, rye. These are products that add mouthfeel, flavor, head retention, and can add turbidity. So what is turbidity? I think you've heard of hazy IPAs. I suspect some of you have had some. That cloudiness in the beer, that is turbidity. We would use these products to help add that along with certain types of yeast. We typically source these from alternative vendors. We have capabilities to produce these products ourselves. We have existing demand. We have the distribution network readily available. And the ability to source these raw materials through our existing relationships and infrastructure. Next slide, please. So finally, warehouse and distribution is delivering more to the bottom line. We are delivering improved returns. We understand the markets we participate in. We understand where our profits come from, and we understand both where risk sits and where opportunities reside. We've invested in tools, process improvements, and have added capabilities to our teams. our value proposition in both the products and services we offer our customers will be in a constant state of evolution. And finally, we are focused on being easy to do business with for not only our customers, but also for the people within United Malt who service those customers. Thank you. And I will now hand it over to Erica Morgan, our Chief People Officer.
Thank you, Brian. Good day to all of you joining us here, as well as virtually. I'm happy to be able to give a very brief update on people and culture at United Malt and how our work is supporting the organization. As you heard from Mark earlier, I have the privilege of leading our HR organization globally and partnering with leaders around our company to put people at the center of all we do. I say that because I sincerely believe that it is our people, their impact and contributions that are delivering against our strategic objectives and helping us realize the benefits as well as the shareholder value we've committed to. We're doing that with things like implementing our new systems, improving our processes, connecting our solutions as well so that they speak to one another and give us that real-time access to data, all to make us more effective and efficient. People are just one of the reasons I'm excited to join this organization, the incredible heritage that we have in our brands, and the amazing opportunity and case for change. This kind of work, leading large-scale people, process, and technology changes that help companies grow in a more scalable and sustainable way, is the hard but exciting work that I've been doing for companies like Nike and Mars for the last 20 years, and where I believe that HR can add tremendous value. What I find myself most encouraged by now is, despite the unprecedented challenges that we've experienced in the organization, I see our employees are incredibly resilient, and they are still focused on working towards our aggressive change agenda, albeit not at the pace of change we planned. What I've also seen has exposed some areas of opportunity that we absolutely need to strengthen. That is in better support to our organization to be able to manage through these challenges. The focus is on building a more constructive culture, one that encourages feedback and improving on ourselves and our skills, focusing on working together to deliver results and outcomes, and reinforcing the importance of our individual impact as well as our collective contributions. We're also strengthening our capabilities across the entire organization, but in particular, we have focus on management, as well as creating more capacity for us to accelerate the pace of delivery, establish business excellence, and work on continuous improvement efforts that are both for the betterment of the organization and for our employee development. This focus on people, culture, and capabilities are key enablers for us in delivering results and driving change. As we turn to the work that we've been doing, all of the initiatives and work in flight that you've heard today are really in support of our ability to transform for tomorrow by streamlining and strengthening our ways of working and our organization. Evolving our organization and our operating model into a more integrated version of the way that we can work for us means that we have standardizations in place across the organization to easily govern the way that we work, move talent across the organization. It's also about optimizing our one global network, where we can work more collaboratively and cross-functionally, that is service delivery focused, commercially driven, and cost-conscious, and ultimately, as Brian mentioned earlier, easy to do business with. We've already seen some proof points with our North America operations consolidations, early efficiency indicators with our transportation management solution in the processing space, and with having brought in new leaders and capabilities. The work that we've done is focused both on our strategy and aligned to our cultural assessment survey results, where our employees helped us identify three priority areas we need to do better. That's number one, improving and increasing communication. We're using tools like fortnightly all-company newsletters as well as United Malt Town Halls. The second is around clarifying our roles and our goals. This is where we've worked to harmonize our organizational structure as well as reviewing job descriptions, and this year we established aligned goals and KPIs and cascaded those through the organization. The third is investing in our employees and leadership development. We're pulling on a number of key data points to help us inform what a capabilities and competency framework will look like, as well as being able to meaningfully tailor the content within our development programs. These areas of focus are fully supported by our leaders. They help build a framework for clear accountability and help to support an empowered culture working to improve. Lasering in on sustainability at United Malt from a human resource perspective for us means we equally value not only what we do, but how we do it. The how we highlight ensures our values govern the way that we work and that we do good by our people, our products, our partners, and our planet. We've maintained our priority one focus on our employees' health and physical and psychological safety. I've hit on our focus on culture for us, which includes diversity and inclusion, going to increase representation across the board, but in particular women in our workforce. And lastly, building awareness across the organization on what potential human rights or modern slavery issues may exist within our industry, how to spot those, as well as how to address. Supporting our sustainability agenda with these efforts and the foundation of best practices that Tiago referred to reinforces the United Malt Way mindset within our organization. And in closing, what I hope that you're able to take from our brief time together here is that we are focused on building a more constructive and productive culture, one where we work collaboratively to get better and succeed together, where we strengthen our capabilities to be as effective and agile as the future requires, and where we're creating more capacity within our organization to deliver against our objectives. This has all been in service for us to prepare our people and our organization with the change readiness needed to advance our business while we are modernizing our solutions as our customer and market demands change and our market and industry trends evolve. I appreciate the chance to spend with you a little bit of time to share how United Malt is putting people at the center of all we do. And with that, before I take questions, I'll invite our management team up so that we can do Q&A together. Thank you.
Thanks, Erica. I appreciate it. If I can get the three of you to come up, it would be great. Just a couple comments here. One is I understand we're running a little bit long, but we're available to continue to answer questions. I understand that you may have some time constraints. Also make mention that there is a lunch, a light lunch afterwards as well. For those of you that want to stick around and would certainly continue to answer questions on an individual basis for you. So with that, I would open it up for questions.
Thank you. I'm Sean Su from COSA Research. The first question, I guess it's more a question for Ryan. Slide 24, when we talk about the $26 million implementation cost for the new technology platform, my question is, this is taken below the line, as in it's not including in your FY23 underlying EBITDA guidance. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
The second question is more for Mark. Just follow up on your comment on the dynamic pricing within processing segment. My question is, have you lost any consumers since implement this new cost, this new model? And I guess more important, how many consumers are we talking about here? Are they all on this new cost, dynamic costing structure, or some of them still paying fixed pricing at the moment?
Yeah, so we haven't lost any customers instituting the dynamic pricing in place. And when we get to 1 January, it'll be 100% across all of our business. So our customer and our contracts go by calendar year. So that's where we have that tail into the first quarter of FY23, but they'll be all fully adjusted by 1 January 23.
Thank you.
Thank you. David Bobucky from Macquarie again. Maybe one for Ryan or Mark, just in terms of the capital allocation framework. You mentioned the return on capital employed target of at least 10%. I'm just thinking about where you're coming from in terms of returns. Are there any additional comments you can kind of make in terms of your confidence in achieving that at least 10% and the timing around that, please.
Do you want to take it, Ryan?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So we already have, you know, if you think about some of Tiago's initiatives already, those are generating more than 12% IRR. So we already have a couple of initiatives that are well ahead of that. And I think I'll go back to what I said before. While I wouldn't necessarily be the generator of ideas and initiatives for capital improvements, I certainly see my role as being able to not only measure that and be able to say yes or no, but also to help shape those in some cases. And I think that's, whether we can work on the expense side or work on the return side of it, I think it's oftentimes what we can do to help with that. But I can assure you from my seat, we wouldn't knowingly take make a CapEx improvement without knowing we were going to generate an IRR of 12% or more.
I'd just add, David, there's an approved PMO process in place that starts with just even looking at the project itself before it even seeks approval. And I think there's just a much more prioritized aspect of where we've got to improve the returns. So certainly part of that will help because we'll go back to better earnings. But I think it's just the improvement in process here will better prioritize exactly where we are putting our money. To the earlier question, would we spend the $60 million if we didn't have the projects? And absolutely not. If it's not reaching what we need to have for returns, then we'll just spend less in a given year.
Thank you. And just one last one for me in terms of the broader market environment. I mean, you mentioned beer sales are forecast to grow over the next 5 years, but we're getting into a more challenging economic environment. What do you think are the biggest risks for UMG into the next 12 months?
Well, certainly, what effect does recession have? Typically, beer is kind of referred to being recession-proof, but what ends up happening is that there is a downscale from premiumization to cheaper beers, and so we're watching that. I know O'Brien's paying attention if it has any impact on what he has going on. The other part I would say is that a lot of the beer growth that you see in the future is not about big growth in beer consumption in established markets. It's in Asia, it's in Latin America, and so hence the projects that Brian's working on going into New Mexico. The risk that we have where some of the growth over in Asia is that the supply chain situation on containers in particular actually erodes from where it's at. But that's why what we put in our budget, I think you heard Ryan say, is that we're making the assumption that they stay where they're at. No improvement, sure. But they don't get any worse. Sure. So those would be the risks that we would see. Renee, do we have any online? Okay.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking more questions. Just a question on the first half, second half profit EBITDA skew. So historically, you've been kind of 40-60 roughly first half, second half. What is the right skew going forward? And the reason I ask is because in the FY23 guidance, it implies the second half EBITDA is like a 59% skew, which sort of surprised me because we're saying the first half of 23 is a bit softer, so I would have thought the second half skew there should have been well over 60%. So just how do I think about that, please?
Yeah, can I answer just a top on this, and you can certainly fill in. Mm-hmm. So traditionally, we've had this 40-60, and then we came out of 19 and had COVID influence in all of this, and we saw that it got balanced a little bit more, that it was 45-55, sometimes almost 50-50. And now that we're going back through and modeling this, that tradition of 40-60 has changed. So what we originally saw as being maybe a more COVID-related issue, here's where we see some changes coming. And a lot of it has to do with United Malt's profile. So if I take distilling as an example, there is no seasonality to the distilling. They're producing whiskey to put in a barrel for the next 10-plus years. So as we see the expansion going on, Scottish expansion, that's going to level that out a little bit more. The other aspects is we see ourselves growing in Mexico. That's going to make a difference because that seasonality doesn't exist that far south, and particularly in Latin America. So when we went back and looked at, I think it was you and I, Ryan, looking at it, is that when we started looking at the profile, a 45-55 split is already there, and we think that's going to get more balanced.
That's right.
So that's kind of a good news for us. It helps us a little bit from a production aspect, and it also helps us from a, I'll just call a capital management, working capital balance as well. Anything to add to that, Ryan?
You know, I'd probably add one additional piece of color in what you're seeing. I mean, I think Mark raised some good points in terms of the product mix changing, which would inevitably kind of level out those across the quarters. But really what you're seeing in 2023, which is unique, is the fact that, sorry, our contracts are on a calendar year, obviously differs from our fiscal year. And so what you're seeing is that we'll call it the tail as we improve our contracts. That tail from the contracts are in place today, really kind of having a little bit of a depressive, putting some pressure on our EBITDA in our first fiscal quarter. So then you'll see a nice march, a jump up in Q2, and then ending the year stronger than what we certainly, you know, $20 million per quarter stronger than what we go into the year with. So you'll see a nice improvement that's going to make that first quarter look light and the second quarter look a little heavier.
Got it. And just as more of a high-level sort of question, going forward as we get past COVID and some of these more supply-side type issues, are there any reasons why normalized processing profit margins going forward may structurally not get to what they used to be pre-COVID? Maybe there's some elements of the cost base going forward that will just structurally, you think, be higher. Maybe it's to do with the fact that gross margins will structurally be lower because the mix hasn't quite returned to what it was with specialty versus base malts. Just interested in your thoughts on go forward processing margins.
Yeah, and so then the other side I would say is positive, and that is that we're operating as an industry in a region at a very high utilization rate, and so I think that's helpful to what the gross margins would look like. I'd also tell you that we have a very committed issue in dealing with the rate of growth that we've seen in the SG&A, and so it's really getting after that. And part of that is that we think ERP will bring a lot of help to that because it's just going to make, our employee base more productive. So I'm not talking so much about headcount. It's just that we can continue to grow the business without having to add into the SG&A, and a little bit on the corporate costs that we brought in when we set up United Malt. We're starting to see some of the benefits of reduced costs on that side. I know our insurance risk people will say that we're developing a long enough history now as United Malt, and so we're seeing improvements on premiums, just those type of things. But We have a very accepted challenge, and that is to deal with the growth that we've seen in the SG&A over the past, well, I'll say 5 years, so
right.
pre-United Malt.
One last very quick question for Ryan. Just are you able to comment on what the leverage ratio looks like in FY22, net debt EBITDA, even roughly?
You know, I think we mentioned we'd be outside of the target range that we're looking at, but really, you know, we'll get some relief from our working capital. We'll certainly need to, you know, build up inventory for the Scottish expansion, but you know, once we get the EBITDA in 2023, we should be just fine.
Okay, thanks.
Mark, just a sort of another high level question. Do you think the fact that your major competitors tend to be farmer-led co-ops that you could argue have a different motivation, less commercial focus, more, has that, you know, and potentially they set the level of the sort of standard for contracts and for commercial returns. Has that, do you think that's a factor in what seems to be a pretty slow response to changing market conditions and potentially lower industry returns than what you might see in industries that are much more sort of driven by for-profit competitors?
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic, John. I think part of the erosion on the risk sharing, that's part of it. But I think that's turning, and the reason I say that is because, yes, the big The top three maltsters are owned by French cooperatives. But they have a lot of independent ownership or non-cooperative ownership that has come in. So if I take Bort Malt as an example, when they bought Cargill Malt, they had Tamasac as a big investor coming in. In Vivo, buying Soufflé recently, that was KKR money coming in, as well as Crédit Agricole. So I think there's a different standard here. I think they're literally looking at things much more appropriately, the right return on capital. And so I don't see that as being a negative influence. It may have been there in the past, but I don't see that on a go-forward basis.
Thanks for that. And just one last question from me. Just in terms of discussions you're having with your banking syndicate, is there going to be a point where you'll be able to say they've been finalised, or are we going to be in this sort of nether region of just ongoing banking discussions for the next year until you get back into the target range?
No, we're going to have to come to solutions on this before we get to the end of this fiscal year, 30 September. So I would anticipate that we will be in that position and we'll be able to let our owners know the solution. Again, we're solving it not just for 30 September. It's solving it through the cycle in FY23. So concentrating a lot on making sure that the solution fits, which typically our top what I'll call ratio is typically right around 31 of March. So we'll be solving for that as well.
Can I just, sorry, just one last one. Is your target gearing range of 2 to 2.5, is that the same as banking covenants?
No, 2, 2.5 is what we think this organization can operate with plenty of headroom. So not just so that we're keeping the balance sheet in shape, but also gives us availability to deal with any opportunities that come along that we don't see. So that's why we like to drive at that 2 to 2.5 times. But it's not tied to our covenants.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry, just a follow-up question on the debt. Are there any surplus assets that you could look to liberate, crystallize value out of to reduce the debt situation?
So looking through the portfolio, Simon, there may be some businesses that we would look at our assets and say they're underperforming, so we would look at those type of situations. But we utilize so much of what our base is, and in some respects it's fairly unique. So if you're kind of driving to the point, can we do an infrastructure play or something like that? Certainly that would be an option that we could take a look at, but I wouldn't tell you that we are an entity in the type of facilities that we own that would set itself up well for that, but everything's on the table. So,
Brian, can I just throw to you, on slide 42 and 43, I think you talked about, let me get back it up, the dynamics in the craft industry, and you said it was an attractive industry, and I know it's been a great business. If I look at those charts on 43 and 44 and the attractive market dynamics around the craft beer market, you're mapping out an industry that's grown very strongly in volume from 12 to 15, say, and then volume has been fairly, it's still grown, but much lower growth rates. If you look at the number of brewers, obviously there was a period there where profitability or revenue per brewer would have increased quite significantly, but then we've seen an increased number of brewers and volume's not growing with the same level of sales. So the question I'm really getting to is, obviously there's been a very attractive industry here. You've seen, as always in North America, you've seen increased competition and not a new entrance. So can you talk to the profitability of the individual brewers, and particularly now that the economy's tightening over there, we're seeing interest rates go up. How are you seeing in terms of working capital terms, profitability of these brewers, and the capacity for the market to continue to grow at the rate it has? Because I'm looking at the consumption charts, it's showing
not the same level of growth, but yet the number of brewers has been continuing to grow. So I'm just trying to understand, is 12-13% of volume in the US sort of maturity, or is there more upside, and what's the level of profitability? What's the risk around your receivables in this warehouse and distribution business?
So the key aspect for us is these smaller brewers, and many of them are very small. I mean, the vast majority of them are going to make less than 500 barrels a year. They can be profitable selling that over the counter. Obviously, it drives much more profit for them than working through distribution channels. I also see one of the things for us is that Country Malt is the essence of who we are. We are a supply chain solution. So as Mark said earlier, we've invested quite a bit of money in our systems and our tools and adding capability for us to also look to utilize our assets in other ways to drive value. But as far as what I see with craft, I just see a continued drive toward the small, the local, and that's what we saw before. That was what was happening before COVID hit, where all the growth was on the small angle. And I would expect that to continue because it can be profitable.
Can I just ask another question?
Yeah, so receivables, actually we have a very low risk, Simon, on that. Most of these really small guys, the way they operate, their working capital or debt, is having one or two credit cards that have $25,000 limits on it. So we hold very few types of receivables because it just comes across on the credit cards.
But as interest rates go up, obviously, isn't the cost of funding is going to go up? I mean, are they not more susceptible to going broke in their environment or not?
And we'll certainly watch for that. So the susceptibility could be is if they're seeing their demand drop, right? So then their cash flows go down. But again, from a credit side, the credit card is not that they're putting and carrying debt on them. They just use it as a way to transfer cash. So they're actually a pretty robust group. To Brian's point, that's where the numbers of breweries are growing, but you're getting a shift in terms of where is craft beer being consumed. And so that's why the people that are or entities that are brewing and trying to push it into distribution channels, that's a problem for them because they're losing access to that as well as their cost is going higher. So the loss of access is that you're having a consolidation in the distribution business, and for them to create their efficiencies, they just carry less labels into distribution. So some of these craft guys are losing distribution if they're trying to use a traditional channel.
Can I just ask Brian a follow-up question? In Australia, we've seen consolidation. Some of these craft brewers have been bought out by the majors, so obviously Stone and Wood's the most relevant recent example. Are you seeing the same trend in North America? And if so, is that creating a risk around them wanting to squeeze working capital terms or margins and push more risk back onto you?
So we'll start with Australia and New Zealand. So yes, no doubt you have seen considerable consolidation there. But for us, Prior Malt sells into pretty much all of them. Now, obviously, the access to market is largely controlled by a couple large retailers, but then we'll also see as more on-premise grows, which we're seeing follow a similar trend to what we've seen in Canada, it'll be higher returns for us when we're selling into that space. But we do business with the vast majority of those brewers that already have distribution channels. As far as in the U.S., yes, we have seen larger craft breweries getting purchased, and access to customer becomes one of the issues that we're trying to see. So for us, some of our goals is how do we use our distribution channels, our distribution network to help provide solutions for that. That's certainly something that we're looking at. But what they don't do is they don't typically change the specialty malt or the bagged malt regime, and they will look to bring in and perhaps brew it at one of the larger breweries on the bulk side. But to date, we haven't seen much change in their appetite or interest in messing around with the specialty malt. In matter of fact, some of these larger brewers don't have the ability to take bags or even to mill it because their kit's not set up to do it. So some instances, Country Malt would be blending and milling the products for them for them to get into the grain stream.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah, then we can break for lunch.
Thanks, Mark. So we've got a question from Grant Saligari, and he was just asking in relation to the chart we showed on the barley price coming off since May, and you know how that reconciles with our comments earlier in the trading update that sourcing costs have increased.
Yeah, it's a good question, and the reason why I showed it on the chart is so we have seen, it depending upon the region, where barley prices have come down, which Europe is a good example. They've fallen $30-$40 a ton. Part of that is just a harvest pressure type of aspect. So it depends region by region. But even with that drop in price, we're still running at basically double the price for malt barley than where we were in a more normalized situation just 18 months ago. So I think it's like a lot of commodities where you peak into the uncertainty, then you come off the peak, and then you come to a run rate. So that's what we feel today. And a little bit concerned that if we aren't getting the exports coming out of Black Sea, that we could see another run-up that goes on. If I take in our areas, the Canadian marketplace really hasn't had much of a drop in price at all. We've come off some of the extreme levels that we had back in March and April, and everybody was trying to solve for that, and so we've come down from there. But we've been flat prices running basically through the summer and now coming into harvest.
I've got a similar and follow-up question from Jonathan Snape, just in relation to barley. How much of the barley costs would you have been able to recover without restructuring our contracts because of the crop improved crop conditions this year? And also asking what you're seeing in terms of North American export demand for the upcoming year.
Export demand on malt, I assume,
malt,
is what he's saying.
Done.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay. So I'll answer that one first, and that is that has a lot to do with supply chain issues. So virtually all of it goes out by container. We have had a Japanese customer and another one looking at it that is taking by bulk just because they need it so bad. But if we're taking under the assumption that we're seeing no improvement but nothing worse, then that channels us into what those volumes can end up being. And one of the areas or categories that we've had in our drop in 22 has been on that export side. So that's the issue that we need to look at. The first part of the question, help me again, was...
The first part was in relation to how much of the barley cost would you have recovered without restructuring?
Yeah, it's. I would say that part of it would have happened anyway because of security of supply. The more important thing is getting that discipline and behavior change has a lot to do with reducing the risk that we have on a go-forward basis. And it also allows us, particularly in the long term, that we are, in essence, capturing the changes in the contract that does a better job of protecting the improvement in the margins and also managing the risk. So it's a kind of a hypothetical. I can't give you a full answer. All I'm saying is that the changes are really making a difference on a go-forward basis.
Just another question here from Angus Hewitt. Given tight supply of malt, which appears to set to persist in the near term, has United Malt's pricing power increased?
There is no question that it's increased. You know, security of supply is a big issue. One of the things that we were very conscious of in 22 was to make sure that what Tiago had mentioned, and that is that we had continued to perform. And so the issue is not just security of supply, but it's security of quality. And so our customers have been coming straight back at us, and in some cases actually wanting to buy more. And I think that's not that their demand is going up. I think they're saying is we want to have, I'll just call more inventory for security of supply.
And a further question, here from Tim Johnston. Curious on the acceptance of the of the customer base in regards to the change in commercial terms. Are these unique to United Malt within the industry, or do other maltsters have similar commercial arrangements? And given you're transferring some risk back to the customer, is there some potential of reduction in potential dollar margin per tonne compared to history?
Yeah, and we had similar questions earlier on that side, but the industry one is unique, so I'll kind of answer that one. We are seeing changes by the industry that is taking on similar type of changes in terms. I actually believe we help kind of lead the process, but part of that is our role because we're so big in North America that I don't think we could get these changes made if we didn't actually lead it. It's good to see that we see other industry participants doing the same thing. And I just think that whole risk issue has to get rebalanced again, and we need to be a big part of it.
Question from Mark Toppy. Is there any comments that craft brewers have pulled back from their range? How does Brian see this, and what are the opportunities for new product development on a go forward?
That's all yours, Brian. Did you catch that question?
No, I didn't. I couldn't hear it.
Sorry, Brian. It was just a question in relation to that have craft brewers pulled back on their range of product requirements, and how are you seeing that? And also, what are the opportunities that remain for you in the new product development space?
Yeah, and I think you heard me talk about the ancillary growth that we've seen through the years, and certainly that's an opportunity for us. I think they have... The ones that have cut back on their range was largely due to access to customers through COVID. I mean, we're starting to see the smaller brewers, the ones that Country Malt's ideally suited to service, are making a wider range of products. Also, as we get into the fall and the winter months in the Northern Hemisphere, we will see increase in specialty malt usage specifically to make what we would call Oktoberfest beers or winter warmers, stouts and porters that you would typically see in the winter months. So I would expect to see that continue to increase. As far as innovation for us, I think the Euro Pils would be a great opportunity, but there's an interesting one. If we talk about, you heard me talk about turbidity. I mean, we carried Opal in our portfolio for the longest of times and couldn't sell it. And then all of a sudden, hazy IPAs took off, and it became a big growth engine for us. So I think a lot of what we try to do is stay at or ahead of the craft brewer to make sure that we have such a broad portfolio that when they're looking to add something or create something new, we're at the ready to act for them and use our malt innovation team and people in our business to grow that.
Okay. Any further question here? Otherwise, certainly appreciate you attending. I hope we have given you a good sense of what we've got going on, things we're working on. I would just say again is that I think a progression of giving you information and how we're doing and any changes in the marketplace that will be more forthcoming and more structured, Graham, can I put it that way? Because that's certainly what where the board is at, and I think it's something we should be doing for investors as well. So with that, thank you very much, and there is a light lunch outside.